I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. Look for their newest line, Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Greetings and welcome to Animal Instinct here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Celia Kutcher, also known as the Food Healer, and welcome to the show. I did want to take a quick second to acknowledge the passing of Tom Petty today. He was a huge part of my childhood and my teen years. And after what's happened in Las Vegas and this, I think we're all pretty wounded today. And I just wanted to acknowledge that and say that, you know, Tom, I hope you're okay. You had a lot of love here. And from that, let's just get this started. So I'm going to be interviewing Mike Vecchione today of the Smithsonian. We're going to talk about deep sea and cephalopods, which cephalopods are one of my favorite things. So I'm really excited about this. Hey, Mike, are you there?
I am.
Thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to talk to me about all this stuff. I'm really excited. How are you today?
Glad to do it.
Thank you. How have you been? How are you doing?
Just fine, thank you.
Oh, good. So, if it's okay with you, I'd like to just dive in. Is that all right?
Sure.
And no pun intended. Sorry about that. So, how long have you been researching the ocean?
Well, my research started in graduate school, so that started in 1976.
Oh, wow.
My first marine biology course was in high school, and that was in 1965.
Wow.
So, a long time.
So, yeah, you know what you're talking about then. That's awesome.
Well, that remains to be seen.
Fair enough. So we're talking about the deep sea. I mean, how far down are we talking?
Well, I usually talk in terms of meters, but I've gone ahead and done the conversions to feet. So most deep sea scientists think of the deep sea as being deeper than about 200 meters, and there are several reasons for that.
Wow.
But that's about 656 feet.
Wow.
So pretty deep. And If you want something to compare it with, the Washington Monument is a little less than 200 meters tall, so a
wow.
little more than the height of the Washington Monument.
God, that's amazing. It's, you know, it's something that it's like you hear about how deep the oceans can be, and then to hear like actual numbers, it's staggering. And so,
well, it goes much deeper than that. So that the average depth is a little less than 4,000 meters. It's
holy cow!
700. So it's about almost 2.4 miles average depth.
Really? Wow.
And then the deepest depth in the ocean is about 11,000 meters, which is about 6.8 miles deep.
Holy cow! And where's that?
That's in the Mariana Trench, which is in the Western Pacific.
And so I'm assuming that different oceans have different depths. Is that right?
Yeah. When you say different depths, you're talking about maximum depths, I'm sure.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, so there's actually quite a big difference between the maximum depth in the Atlantic, maximum average depth in the Atlantic, and the maximum average depth in the Pacific. So in the Atlantic, it's about 3,300 meters, whereas in the Pacific, it's 42, almost 4,300.
Wow.
It's almost 1,000 meters deeper in the Pacific in average depth.
And do you know why that is?
It's got to do with the geological history of the Earth and the spreading of the plates that make up the surface of the Earth.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And so one of the questions that I've got for you is, you know, there. I know that this parts of the seafloor have been mapped. How much of it do you think at this point has been mapped accurately?
Well, that's almost every question you ask me, I would have to answer, it depends.
Fair enough.
All of the ocean has been mapped with satellites. So you can tell how deep the ocean is by measuring the height of the water with satellites, and that gives them an indication. But it's not very high-definition mapping. So we've got a general idea of the bottom structure in the oceans of the whole world. But when you're talking about getting down to smaller scale, the scale is really important if you're interested in exploring or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all of the ocean has not been mapped. Very little of it has.
Wow.
There's a big effort going on right now to map the edges of the territorial waters of the different countries that have oceanfront.
Uh-huh.
Because of the International Law of the Sea, which is a United Nations treaty.
Huh. And so, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, mapping the ocean floor is obviously something that's important and is needed for science and for other things. But it's something that it just seems to be, it just seems so vast that even the ability to map like certain countries' waters just seems like it's a task that would just be an incredible undertaking.
It's a really huge undertaking, but it's also really important, both in terms of international law, because that'll define what rights the different countries have to mineral rights and things like that, oil exploration and so on, but also for practical purposes, like just as an example, a U.S. Navy submarine several years ago was doing a high-speed underwater run and hit an uncharted seamount, an undersea mountain.
Oh, wow.
And it caused a lot of damage, killed a couple of people, and the reason that that accident occurred was because we didn't have accurate maps of that area.
Mm-hmm.
So mapping is really important.
It's really wild, too, to think that would happen. You know, it's something that it's kind of like, I think that a lot of people just assume that, you know, when you go to the beach and you get in the water and it slowly gets deeper, that this depth is going to be consistent. And it doesn't seem like it is in the most part.
No, there's actually a lot of structure. The canyons and the trenches in under the ocean are much more dramatic than they are on land. They're deeper canyons than the Grand Canyon, and then there's ocean ridges that go all the way around the world. That they're much longer and larger than any of the mountain ranges on
wow. the continent. Wow. I mean, I was fortunate enough to live near a cliff wall, basically, that was underwater when I was a kid. And it was like, I always remember, like, getting there, you know, it's like and I always snorkeled. I can't dive because I start laughing and then I just go up, you know, I can't do that. But it's like, you know, swimming to it and it's like, everything's fine. It's just, you know, it's deep water. But it was probably about 30 or 40 deep where the cliff started. And it's like the second you swim over that cliff, you do get that feeling of vertigo and kind of, you know, you're going over a cliff, so you're expecting to fall. But it's amazing how deep it would be. I mean, I was down in the Atlantic, basically, like, you know, what we used to call the Caribbean side of the Bahamas. And it's really shallow there. And it was like hitting this wall was something that was just so shocking. And it just seemed so out of place, you know. And it was to see this and to see the instantaneous going from a light turquoise water to looking down and seeing it almost black was always really disconcerting. And it always fascinated me because it was just a cliff, you know. And it's something that if I had not seen it, especially as a child, wouldn't have really realized that this exists, and they're pretty common, you know. It's wild.
That's true. It depends on where you are. There are a lot of flat surfaces in the bottom of the ocean, but there's a lot more structure than most people realize. And those drop-offs, like you talked about, are really important for some kinds of animals. So the types of animals that live on the hard rock walls as they drop off would be quite different than the animals that live on the soft sediment. It's fairly flat, too.
Yeah, I think that most people think that, you know, underwater, you've got coral and you've got sand and, you know, seaweed and fish and that kind of thing. And it's,
right.
you know, there's so much more down there, like these walls, you know, that it's just kind of, even that I think is kind of surprising for a lot of people that haven't spent a lot of time in the water. And I've spent a lot of time in the water. And I mean, honestly, that's one of two cliffs that I've seen in my entire life, you know, so it's something that I think it's common for certain people, like the cliff where I was, people would specifically come to dive that cliff because it's a
right.
pretty accessible one, you know, but for, I think for most people, it's kind of like, wait, they're cliffs?
And so, because it's exciting. because there's different things living there.
God, it used to freak me out. I totally couldn't handle it. It was like, giant fish, swim back, kind of thing. And so how far down, like, this is one of the questions I've actually always wanted to know. Obviously, the deeper you go, the water gets colder because the sun can't get to it. But, like, how cold are we talking?
Well, in the deep ocean, the average temperature is just above freezing. So it's like between 35 and 36 degrees Fahrenheit mm-hmm. through most of the deep water. Depending on where you are, there's some places like in the Mediterranean or the Red Sea where the deep water is much warmer, but most of the deep ocean is very cold.
And is there any difference to the water in terms of like texture or quality when it's super deep than it is closer to the surface?
Not in terms of texture or something like that, but there's a big difference in the amount of floating plant material, the phytoplankton, that not only provide most of the food in the ocean, but it also provides half of the oxygen on Earth.
Wow.
But so as you go deeper, you get less and less sunlight, and that phytoplankton depends on the sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
So once you get out of that top 200 meters, that's one of the reasons we use that cutoff, is because that's about as deep as sunlight will penetrate and still promote this growth of this phytoplankton. Once you get below that, then the water's generally clearer because there isn't these microscopic plants floating around.
Okay,
and
that
then you
makes
get
sense.
Close to the bottom, and then there's currents that stir up the mud and cause what's called turbidity. So there are differences as you go deeper through the water. Differences not just in light penetration, but also in temperature and in the things that are related to those variables.
I mean, is there a difference in, like, salinity levels?
Not so much salinity. Temperature is the really big difference as you go deeper in the water. There are some changes in the saltiness,
mm-hmm.
but it's usually not a strong enough change that it matters to the animals that live there. What it does matter as far as figuring out water flow, because saltier water is denser at the same temperature,
mm-hmm.
and figuring out how salty the water is really important for what we call physical oceanography, calculating the currents and that sort of thing.
Cool. And so how far down have you guys found sea life?
Sea life lives to the deepest depths of the ocean. I said the deepest trench was 6.8 miles deep.
Yeah.
They found crustaceans living at the bottom of that along.
Really?
Things like there's single-celled organisms called foraminifera
mm-hmm.
that live down there as well. So it's not very well explored. It's really difficult to study down there. But we do know that there are things living even at those extreme depths.
Like, if you're going, I mean, I don't even know. Are submarines capable of going that deep?
There are a few, but there are very few.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember, James Cameron actually, the movie.
Yes, I totally remember this. Yes.
He actually built a submarine to go down to the bottom of the Challenger Deep, which is the Mariana Trench. And there are a couple of remote-controlled robot submarines that have made the dives down there, too.
Well, like, so there hasn't
Cameron
been, like...
Cameron did it. There was only one sub that had dived that deep, and that was back in the 60s. It was
really?
An old Navy vessel that it was basically a steel ball hanging underneath a float made up of a bag of gasoline.
Oh, God.
And they made it down to the bottom of the deepest part and came back up. But then we waited for almost 60 years before anybody else did.
Wow.
But like I said, there are robot submarines now that can make that trip, too.
And so those can bring up samples and things like that so you guys can research it.
Right, yeah.
That's really wild.
Very few, but there are some.
Unbelievable. And, I mean, you know, this is something, actually, this is something I've been dying to ask you since we've got this interview. I mean, I go to the Natural History Museum in Manhattan all the time. Uh-huh. And some of the deep sea fish look like something that Tim Burton would have made for, like, some kind of haunted ocean thing, you know? It's like the lantern fish and the ones that with the lights and all this kind of thing. I mean, how long have these fish been around? And have they evolved much since they first came onto the planet?
Well, again, the answer is
totally
a little confusing, but the fossil record for deep sea animals is not very good.
Mm-hmm.
But we can assume that deep sea fishes have been around for a very long time because fishes have been around for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
The first fishes evolved in what's called the Cambrian, so that was 500 million years ago.
Wow.
And then what's called the age of fishes was a little bit less than that, but from about 350 to almost 500 million years ago, the fishes were really diverse and took over most of the planet, or most of the ocean.
Yeah.
So we can assume that there were deep sea fishes at that time, probably.
It's just, they're so freaky looking. I mean, it's like, I remember seeing, I don't even know if the name lanternfish is right, but it was one of these, like, you know, big fish.
There are lanternfishes, yes.
Okay, so then it was probably that one. Is that the one that has, like, the gigantic teeth? It just looks like something out of a child's nightmare.
You're probably talking about a viperfish.
Okay.
Which has the gigantic teeth, and it's got a hinged mouth, which, like a snake.
Yes, exactly.
Why they're called viperfishes. But the lanternfishes have these lights all over their body. They have what are called photophores. They're sort of like a firefly.
Mm-hmm.
They can light up by themselves. So they have not just lanternfishes, but lots of deep sea animals can make their own light. So that's a real important characteristic for deep sea stuff.
So is this so they can see, or is this so they can find a mate?
Yes. Well, it's usually not so they can be seen. It's often so they can be not seen. So, you know, the sunlight comes down from the surface, and if there's something swimming around in the deep, where there's still some sunlight penetrating,
mm-hmm.
that will make a silhouette, which could be seen by a predator swimming below it.
Yeah.
So a lot of fishes and squids and shrimps have these lights along their belly to light up and match the light that's coming down from the surface so that they don't make a silhouette, and so they're harder for a predator to see. But you mentioned finding mates, and some of these patterns of photophores are specific to the different sexes of a species and probably are involved in finding mates.
Is it true that only the female animals can light up?
No, it's not. It depends on what species you're talking about.
Okay.
One of the things that people often ask about are these angler fishes, which a lot of people know about angler fishes because of the movie Finding Nemo.
Yeah, totally.
There was a fish with a lure out in front of it, and that was sort of an angler fish.
Mm-hmm.
And some species of angler fishes, the females are large, and the males are actually parasitic on the female, so they when they find a female, they bite, hang on, and then they basically become part of the female's body.
Wow.
So there's a lot of weird stuff that goes on in the deep sea.
Well, I mean, just some. I was fortunate enough to be in the Galapagos about 12 years ago. And we were on a very small boat. I mean, we were really, really fortunate. And all of a sudden, it was like sunrise, and all of a sudden the captain gets on, and he's like, everybody get up and, like, run to the left side of the boat. And we do. And there is this gigantic sunfish skimming the water.
Yeah.
Having a great time. Holy crap. That was one of the freakiest things I have ever seen in my life. And if you haven't seen a sunfish, basically if you draw like the fish that a child would draw, and then behind the gills, you just took a big, huge bite and left the fish like that. I mean, it's kind of just like this fish head with these little tiny wings on it. And this thing was jumping. It was huge. It was probably at least 6 feet tall and was just like bouncing alongside of the boat like, oh, hi. It was like the ocean fascinates me, because what I've found is no matter how weird you think you could draw a fish, you're going to find it in the ocean. It's pretty much there.
That's what I like about biology. The weirder, the better.
It's really cool. I mean, it just blows my mind. Like, the more time that I spend in the ocean or just, like, researching, and I'm always just like, really? It's so amazing. And it doesn't seem, like, the fascination just never ends. It's always just so incredible and so beautiful on top of it.
I feel the same way.
It's so cool. Well, we need to take a quick break for station identification. I am talking to Mike Vecchione of the Smithsonian Institute, all about deep sea and also cephalopods, which we're going to discuss when we come back. So hang out for about a minute, minute and a half.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. You put a lot of care and thought into what you eat. After all, you're a food radio listener. That thoughtfulness goes hand in paw with how you feed your pets. Purposeful pet food doesn't happen by accident. Castor and Pollux scours the earth to carefully select the best organic and responsibly sourced ingredients. New Pristine from Castor and Pollux is the only complete line of pet food made with ingredients that are responsibly raised, caught, or grown. Feed your dog or cat the new standard, like grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, and vegetables grown without synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides. Pristine from Castor and Pollux. Purposeful pet food. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
And we are back. I am talking to Mike Vecchione of the Smithsonian Institute, all about deep sea and cephalopods. And this is the cephalopod part, so I'm super excited.
Okay.
I love these animals, and I hate to call them animals, but since my show is called Animal Instinct, everything that's not a human is an animal, but that's not a plant, so I'm going with it. Okay, first question for you, actually, are squids in the cephalopod family, or are they a separate thing?
Squids are cephalopods. The group, the cephalopods, includes squids and octopods and some weird groups like vampire squids, which really are not squids. They're more closely related to the octopods. And bobtail squids and cuttlefishes and stuff like that. Those are all cephalopods.
I'm a huge fan of cuttlefish. I think they are just amazing. I love them. I'm going to tie the deep sea and cephalopods together. So do you find a lot of cephalopods in the deep sea?
Well, that's what I work on. That's my specialty.
Cool.
So the answer is yes.
Okay, perfect.
But not in the deepest parts of the deep sea, what are called the trenches.
Mm-hmm.
So there are none that are that have been found yet that live in these really deep sort of gashes in the bottom of the ocean.
Mm-hmm. And because everyone asked me to ask you this, this is the popular vote question. Everybody wants to know about giant squid.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, they want to know how big do they get, like what do they eat, like what's the story with giant squid? Are these guys legends, or are they still around?
Oh, no, they're definitely still around. But the question of how big they get is a really good question. The largest record in the scientific literature was about 58 feet long.
Holy cow!
From a squid that was found floating near shore off of Canada.
Wow.
But nobody's ever found one that big since then. And so there are a few people that have questioned whether they actually get that big or whether somebody just grabbed a hold of the tentacles and pulled real hard until it stretched out as far as it would stretch. Or,
oh, that's terrible.
But they definitely get really big. They get in a 40 or 50-foot range without question.
And so, like, if you're a 40 or 50 foot long cephalopod, like, how big are your arms around? Like, how gigantic are these things?
Well, for a giant squid, most of that length is in fairly long and not real thick arms and tentacles. The tentacles are fairly thin, and then the arms are thicker. So they have eight arms, plus they have two longer tentacles. There's another kind of really big squid, and there's been this controversy over who's got the biggest squid. And the other kind that people have talked about a lot are now being called colossal squids.
Mm-hmm.
They're found around Antarctica.
Really?
They don't get as long as the giant squids do. They might get heavier, but we don't know how big either of those groups really gets as a maximum size. But they're also really big squids. But there's also there are other kinds as well. When I talk about big squids, I'm talking about bigger than me.
Wow.
So there's about a dozen species of squids and a few octopods that get really big.
Wow. Now, I've only ever seen, like, little tiny ones. You know, I've never seen anything that's been like, oh, my God, swim. You know, it's always kind of like, oh, look, it's so cute, you know.
Right, yeah.
Are the giant squids rare or just incredibly elusive?
Well, like all big things, there's not as many really big animals around as there are smaller animals.
True.
But they're not really rare. They're found around the world, basically, except in the Arctic and the Antarctic.
Mm-hmm.
And they're found mostly closer to the continents rather than out in the middle of the ocean. So we think that they're associated with where the continents drop off into the really deep ocean.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about how big that space is, if they're spread out in that space, there's still a lot of animals around.
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting because, I mean, I know that octopuses and squids have a fair amount of predators, but if you're that gigantic, I'm assuming you don't have as many?
Well, there are a few predators. The sperm whales eat them.
Oh, really?
Sperm whales are the largest predators, or, you know, largest toothed predators anyway.
Yeah.
And also, there are large deep-sea sharks that eat giant squids as well.
Really?
Yeah. There are predators that eat them. And remember also that any animal that big grows up from something smaller. And when they're smaller, they can get eaten by other things as well.
That's a really good point. I mean, like, this is such a random question. How big do you think, like, a newborn giant squid is? Do you have any idea?
Well, their eggs are much less than an inch. They're just a few millimeters long.
Oh, wow.
They probably hatch out at about that size.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, then they're doomed for basically anything that's around.
Right.
Wow. And so how ancient are cephalopods?
They have been around pretty much the same as the fishes have. There have been chambered cephalopods around since the Cambrian.
Wow.
You know, 500 million years.
Mm-hmm.
The relatives of the Nautilus, the Nautiloids.
Mm-hmm.
Became diverse in the same era as the fishes became diverse, the Devonians. Again, 350-some to 500 million years ago.
Unreal.
And then modern things, like modern squid-like and octopus-like things, have been around basically since about the dinosaurs, the Triassic and Jurassic and Cretaceous.
Okay. That makes sense. They kind
so
of like
250,
you know,
200 million years. They've been around a long time.
Yeah, they really have, huh? All right, and now I also have a question for you that was asked to me about six times today. What's the story with octopuses having different DNA than anything else on this planet? Everybody's like, oh my God, they're space aliens. Like, how do you guys conclude this as scientists? Or what does this information mean to you guys?
Yeah, the guy that said that immediately regretted it. not that the DNA is not weird. It's just that he made the comparison with aliens, and that immediately took off in social media and so on.
Yeah, it did.
But what's really unusual about octopods and probably cephalopods is that they edit their gene products. So the DNA makes an intermediate that then makes proteins.
Mm-hmm.
So, and most animals can do a little bit of editing of that process, but octopods do it a lot more than any other kind of animal does.
Wow. So what does that enable them to do?
It means that they probably don't evolve as quickly as they would otherwise. You know, they have a short life cycle, and they would probably evolve really quickly because of the short life cycle.
But mm-hmm.
this gene editing means that even though their DNA is changing, the proteins it makes doesn't change as quickly as it would otherwise.
That's wild because I just assumed when you were telling me this that like if they could, you know, willfully change things that they would evolve even quicker. So it's interesting to see that ability actually kind of slows them down because of their lifespan.
Yeah, that's just my speculation.
Fair enough. I think that's fair considering you've been doing this for a long time. And I mean, this is one of these questions too that just it always fascinates me, and I hate that it's this open ended. But like, how smart is your average cephalopod?
Yeah, that's a question I get asked a lot.
I'm sure.
That's the question that I have to say. It depends.
Okay.
It depends on how you define smart. And obviously, they're smart enough to get around on their own.
Yeah, yeah.
They have a very complex nervous system
mm-hmm.
with a very advanced and well-developed brain, and they can do some amazing things. They can unscrew jars to get at a crab inside it.
Mm-hmm.
They can solve problems, puzzles. And
wow.
They do things that we think of as being intelligent, but you got to remember that their brain, if you think about intelligent animals,
mm-hmm.
you might think about dogs or dolphins or maybe even parrots or even fishes.
Yeah.
All of those types of animals are vertebrates, and they all have basically the same brain structure.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a cephalopod, an octopod or a squid, has a structure that's very, very different. Their brain is based on the same structure as that of a snail.
Really?
A ring of nerves that goes around the esophagus. Only it's really well developed in the cephalopods. But in addition to that, they have the well-developed brain, but they also have a lot of nerve structure that's spread out in their body, a lot more than what we're used to with the vertebrates.
Mm-hmm.
So in addition to their central brain, for instance, the octopus has sort of a mini brain associated with each of its arms. And if you cut off an arm, or there are a lot of octopods that can actually drop an arm,
ooh.
It drops its tail.
Yeah, yeah.
And when that happens, the arm can continue crawling around and exploring
wow.
on its own.
Wow.
Because it's got all these nerve structures inside of it.
And can it survive?
Well, it obviously can't feed. So
oh, good point.
Not going to survive very long, but it can keep crawling and wiggling for a long time. And the reason that the octopod drops its arm is because that'll distract a predator while the rest of the octopod gets away.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
The brains of cephalopods have a comparable number of nerves to what you find in dogs and cats.
Mm-hmm.
About a half a billion nerve cells in the brain of an octopus, and only a little bit more than that in a dog or a cat's brain.
Wow.
Plus, that's only a third of their nervous system.
Wow. Yeah, it's like, I love the question, but I also hate it because it's like, I think the fact of the matter is I think it's humans, you know, so much of how smart is it is all about anthropomorphic force. Blah, sorry, good word
right.
for the day. Anthropomorphism.
Right.
You know, so it's like, well, my dog can't do math, so I guess he's not too bright, you know, and that kind of thing. Or like, you know, look, this elephant painted a picture. Ooh, he must be super smart, you know. And so it's, the way that it's kind of, somebody explained it to me this way of, you know, an animal is as intelligent as it needs to be in order to survive, reproduce, and keep going, and to solve problems. And, like, there was this, I'm sure you're totally aware of this, there was some video, I don't remember what kind of fish it is, there's this cute little fish that lives in very shallow water, and they've discovered that he makes, like, these really beautiful patterns out of sand to attract a mate.
Yes,
and
I know.
Everyone went nuts, and everyone's like, oh, my God, you know, animals understand beauty. And I think that conclusion is a little vague for, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's not like, look, baby. I mean, he's doing something beautiful in order to attract a mate, so sort of. But it's like with octopuses being able to, like, you know, come out of their tank and run across a hallway and eat fish in a lab and know, like, the guard's schedules and things like that. It's kind of like, all right, so then they're aware of the routine, you know? And I think that all animals are actually quite smarter than we think they are, give them credit for, because I think that for the average human, our basis for education is kind of like, well, you know, does it have a college degree? Can it read? You know, I think we wind up getting too caught up in what defines intelligence for ourselves.
Right.
You know, that being said, I mean, I've worked with horses for a very long time, and there were definitely horses that were more cunning and seemed smarter than other ones. So I don't think that, like, you know, all fill in the blank of all this type of animal is this smart. I think that there's definitely, you know, room for...
There's individual variability in octopods and squids as well, you know, as far as their personalities and so on.
Like, what's the biggest difference between octopods and squids?
There are a lot of differences that are not entirely consistent. Like, squids, both octopods and squids have 8 arms.
Mm-hmm.
Squids generally have 2 long tentacles also, which are modified arms, so they have 10 arms. But there are some squids that don't have those 2 tentacles and only have the 8 arms.
How funny.
Squids have fins on the sides of their body, which most of the octopods we're familiar with don't.
Okay.
But there are deep-sea octopods that do have fins on the sides of their bodies. So, there are differences. There are consistent differences, but they are somewhat subtle. And you'd be welcome to take my course if you'd like to learn about them.
I mean, I am so fascinated. Careful, because I'll take you up on that. I mean, seriously, like, I am so fascinated by these animals. And, I mean, a couple years ago, my listeners have heard this story ad nauseum, so I'm sorry, you guys, but this is a good one. I was diving down in St. Lucia, and I was 12 feet from a cliff, and it was crappy reefs. Everything was half dead. It was really sad. And I was probably 15 feet offshore, and it was shallow. And so I'm swimming along, and I look up, and there's a little—I guess it was a squid. And he was probably about 5-6 inches long, and he's right in front of me, and he's kind of hanging out in the water. And I was like, "Oh, hi!" And the whole time it was a little bit rough, so I constantly was looking down and to my right to see if I was going to smash into any coral. So I look back up, and there are 3, and they're the same size, and they're equidistant from each other. And I was like, "What is going on?" I look down, I look back up. There is a line of these squids, basically to infinity, in this perfect. It looked like somebody had taken a rule or a piece of string, and they were all hanging out on it. Right. So I looked. It was crazy. And then I looked down again. I looked back up. I'm now surrounded by all these animals. And I'm like, oh, God, I must be in a breeding ground or something. And they're pissed. Like, what's happening here? And then they all started changing colors. And it was magical. And then I looked down. I looked up. And they were all gone. And it was this moment in time that was like, did I really see that? Like, did that really happen?
Yeah, I couldn't even tell you what species it was.
What was that about, man? What was that?
It's called a Caribbean reef squid, and they do that sort of thing. I've seen them do it, too.
Oh, my God, it was so cute. It was like, I was upset, though. I was like, oh, God, am I, like, wrecking their breeding ground? Am I in the middle of a party here? Like, what is going on? Especially when they started all changing colors. It was one of the most mystical, most beautiful moments of my life. I mean, I will definitely never forget it, and it was absolute magic.
Cool.
It was great. And that's basically, I mean, honestly, that's what got me to stop eating all these lovely animals, because let me tell you, it's, you know, I can't do that anymore. It's like, nope, nope, nope. And I just feel so fortunate to have had that moment, because it really was something that was so special. And I'm just hoping that they were saying hi and that they weren't like, what are you doing here? You know, that kind of thing.
Well, they were probably just trying to figure out what you were and why you were there.
Fair enough.
And maybe whether you were good to eat.
God, can you imagine? That would be a bummer, being attacked by like a million little tiny squid. It would be really special. It's like this magic moment, and then all of a sudden, ow, ow, ow.
I wouldn't worry about it.
And so here's my last question for you, which I know could be a doozy, but, you know, what is climate change doing to the deep sea and cephalopods? How badly are they being affected by it?
Well, they are being affected, and more than we used to think it would affect the ocean.
Mm.
When I went to graduate school, basically we were taught that the ocean was so vast that nothing that humans could do could really change it. But it turns out that was wrong. And you might think that the question about climate change, my answer would be about temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been temperature changes in the deep sea. But there are also other things that are going on, like changes in the acidity of the water.
Oh, wow.
Which is really important and less widely covered in the press. So those are direct changes that are happening as a result of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
There are also indirect changes in the ocean, such as climate change will affect the productivity up at the surface. You know, back when we started this conversation, I talked about the little phytoplankton, the plants that float around at the surface.
Yeah.
Produce the food and the oxygen and so on. Well, climate change will affect that productivity, and that's what feeds the deep sea. So if that changes at the surface, the food that goes to the deep sea will change.
Mm.
And also the temperature change at the surface will increase the temperature difference between the surface and the deeper water. It's called stratification, which means that there will be less opportunity for exchange of water between the deep sea and the surface waters. So these indirect changes are as important as the direct changes that are happening from climate change.
Wow. Wow. So basically we got to really do something about climate change, or literally every square inch of this planet is going to be affected. I'm surprised that deep down that it would really affect it, but it makes total sense. And I mean, is part of this from all the sunscreen killing all the reefs?
Not the climate change so much, but what you're talking about has become a big deal as far as reefs, where a lot of people, shallow water coral reefs, where a lot of people snorkel and swim and so on, that the chemicals that they put on their bodies before they get in the water wind up in the water, and that affects the animals that live there.
It's just unreal. It really, really is. Oh, Mike, I've had a great time talking to you. I've learned so much. And
interested.
Oh, my God, I'm so interested. Are you kidding me? I could, talk to you for hours. I'm serious. I really want to take your class. I think it would be amazing. It's definitely something that has always, always fascinated me. And I'm so grateful to have gotten some answers to some of my questions today, because this is, like I said, this topic is very near and dear to me. And I love the fact that we were able to educate some other people, too, about what you do and about what's going on this planet. So for that, I just want to say thank you so much.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to talk to your listeners.
Thank you so much. And for the listeners, thank you guys for tuning in. Next week, we will have a brand new episode of Animal Instinct. So until then, take care.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody. I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.